of you people out here, well, you know me as Chris, the team lead music. We'll be making music all day. My ears are still beeping a bit for playing drums. But I stand in front of you as the director of the Dutch Institute for Vulnerability Disclosure with my team. So in reverse order, you will be seeing Astrid Ozenbrug here at MCA's. She is officer at the Bar Operations Center and also the chair of the Cyber Operations Center. But at DFID, he's the chair of the board. Leonard Oudhoorn, here at MCA, is juggling around with a whole lot of zeros. I don't know what it means, but it's very important. And at DFID, he's the head of CSIRT, which is not the Computer Security Incident Response Team for our own organization, but for the whole world. That's where we put our notifications throughout the rest of the world. And if the DFID itself is in crisis, we have Frank Bredijk, our crisis manager. But here at MCH, he is the Chief Officer Balloonfolding, of course. And he's also the super admin of our hyper-intelligent Telex, through which you can send coded messages. And he has been sending musical requests to us on the stage through his Telex. So thank you very much for that. DFID, the Dutch Institute for Vulnerability Disclosure. We scan the whole IP version 4 of the internet, which is quite a lot. And this is the second time we're here. Because if you remember, 2 days ago, we had the same talk, but in the middle of our talk, somebody pulled an internet cable, and then all the power of the whole plant went down. So we continued offline with all nice Q&A, but you folks at home, you missed the whole talk. So this is take two. So we had a great rehearsal. But yeah, we're 2 days later, so we're all a bit worn out. But we'll make the best of it. The Dutch Institute for Vulnerability Disclosure, this is our mission. We aim to make the digital world safer by scanning the whole internet, reporting vulnerabilities we find in digital systems to the ones who can fix them. So those are mostly the owners of the systems, but sometimes also vendors or their suppliers or their ISPs who put the notification forward, you have this old software running, your configuration is wrong, please fix it, make it safer. That's what, you know, ethical hackers or helpful hackers, how you like to call them, normally do individually to an individual system. We put this on steroids by doing it for the whole internet, with the whole collective, for the whole world. We have a global reach because we scan the whole internet and we notify, but we do it Dutch style, which means it's very open. We all use our real names. It's not really hacker-like. We don't use pseudonyms. We also have an office, you can even call us, which is not very typical for a hacker collective. We do it collaborative, so we work together with many partners. We don't exclude others. We work with everybody just to make the internet safer, like, well, the Red Cross also helps everybody. And above all, we do it for free. We Dutch like free, but it also has a legal consequence why we do it for free. Which brings us to, well, you know, what does it look like, our daily practice? Well, a bit like this. We have our own autonomous system, 50559. So you can recognize us, put us on the allow list, not on the block list, so we can scan you through these IP series. Well, we also use Shodan, but from here, we download the whole list of IP addresses for the vulnerabilities we scan on. So typically, there's a CVE coming out, with a nice number, and we know which version. So we just send a ping to the whole world. Which version are you running? Oh, you have an old version. From the Whois, we look up your email addresses, and then we report to you, you're our leak. We also have a brand of research where we do zero-day research. So then it's not a known vulnerability, but we already start scanning and warning and try to solve it with the vendor. And once there's a patch, again, we warn the whole world. If you just ask for the version of a software, well, that's no rocket science, and that's also legal. But sometimes we need to use, well, sort of non-weaponized exploits to scan your system. And that's probably where things might become a bit taggy. Are you allowed to scan the whole internet? Well, nobody asked you to do so. Nobody allowed you to do it. In the strict sense, it's illegal. We kind of violate all sorts of computer fraud laws. We also kind of violate the GDPR, because all those lists with IP addresses and email addresses, those people never asked us to use them. And moreover, we also hand them to others. So why do we get away with it? Check our code of conduct. It's on the website, it's two pages, but these are the three most important principles, which are not just something we made up, but something which comes out of case law in the Netherlands, but also international. Because you can commit a kind of computer fraud, slightly, if you do it for societal need. So if you're not being paid for it, or you do it out of revenge or to prove yourself, no, you just do it to help. There's no financial incentive. And you see that, well, there's this huge need. Because if we don't, these people remain vulnerable, and then the computer criminals get in there. And it's even worse. And also, we, well, kind of violate your privacy slightly in order to prevent a much larger privacy invasion. So therefore, a societal need is, in several court cases, the first thing a judge looks at. You know, did you do it just to help people? Yes. But if that is established, the judges look further, because you can't just hack anything, saying, oh, yeah, it's for the good cause. So yeah, I broke it down, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, that their system is not running anymore, what's their fault, because it was broken anyhow. No, you can't do that. There comes in the principle of proportionality. So the means you use in order to achieve this goal, is it in proportion to what you try to achieve? So again, you can, well, for example, try to reset an account on admin or info just to see whether the procedures are right. But if you start to reset 100,000 accounts and the system goes down, well, you proved it's not really safe, but it's a too harsh a measure. Also, if we cannot just scan for a version, but we need to use non-weaponized exploits, as if, you know, you're hacking them, the exploits shouldn't ruin the system. You're there to make it safer and not unsafer. So if you have established that, you have a sort of proof of concept that you can scan for good, and it is proportional to what you're trying to achieve, you reverse the process, and that's the principle of subsidiarity. Okay, this is what we want to achieve, this is the means we found for it, this is the scanning method, but can we also use another method which is less invasive? So for example, you can enter a database. You can look around, of course, see what's in there, establish, well, it's a true database, it's actual, it's running, but please just make a screenshot of the folders and go. Don't start downloading all of this data, because you don't need it. It's not proportional, and there are less severe means to use it, subsidiarity. So much for the legal, ethical stuff, the boring stuff. Now we go to the part where you all came for, the case studies, the kind of researches we did. So we take you back in time, a year. Remember the 2nd of July, the biggest ransomware attack ever took place in the world, on Kaseya Feyaza. These criminals thought they could, well, hack about a million organizations with their ransomware, but what they didn't know then was that DFID was already 2 months on the case. And as this is a crisis, I will now hand it over to our crisis manager, Frank.
Thank you.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah, Kaseya. As Mikos, it was one of the biggest cases we've ran up until now. Well, that was my line before I started talking about SolarMan. But it's actually a case that started off with Vice on our right, who's here in a picture with Victor, who unfortunately couldn't be with us due to some health issues. Victor, love you, would like to have you here, but yeah, get well. Kaseya Feyaza's case 2021-0011. And how did it begin? Well, Wietse Boonstra, he's sitting over there, he's a penetration tester by day and a DIVD member by night, as Jambos would put it. And he was doing a pen test of a customer and encountered a product called Kaseya Feyaza. And as he was poking around on the network, trying to find a way in, trying to find a way to get to his flags, he's like, this doesn't sit well with me. I think there's more to have, but I'm running out of time. So Vici being Vici, he took the software home, installed it in his lab, and started playing with it. And was it safe? Well, not really. Initially, we found around 7 CVEs, 3116, a credentials leak and a business logic flaw. Credentials leak in the sense that you could log on, you could get to the system, say, hey, I want to install my agent. You would get an installer file. If you installed the agent, there was an INI file, and in the INI file, there were credentials to log in, and those credentials were credentials for an agent, but you could use them for much more. We also found an authenticated SQL injection vulnerability, a way to write into the database. I think it was a blind one, so you couldn't actually get data out, but you could get data into the database. An unauthenticated remote code execution vulnerability, several cross-site scripting vulnerabilities, I think we all lumped them together. They thought it was smart to handle two-factor authentication on the client side. It isn't. Then we found a local file inclusion vulnerability in the agent, and an XML external entity attack. And that gave two theoretical attack paths. One where you do the authentication bypass, then you use the SQL injection to actually write jobs in Kaseya, because this is a system administration tool, so you could write jobs to say, you know what, install a crypto miner. And I vividly remember joking around saying, or not really joking around. I was like, huh, I wonder, this could be big. You know, this is managed service providers. They have customers. Usually managed service providers have 10, 100 customers. Customers have 10, 100, 1,000 1,000 systems that are, this could be a lot of systems. And then we said, well, if we do an authentication bypass and then an SQL injection, we can look into the database and find out how many clients, how many systems this is. And then we said, well, if we do that, we might as well install a crypto miner on all those things. And it's like, okay, this is where we stop. Something about ethics and proportionality and subsidiarity, all the boring stuff that Chris talked about. Later on, we also found a remote code execution that was unauthenticated, which was even scarier, I guess. And with writing that job in the database, you could actually let those clients do anything. As soon as they pulled Kaseya FSA, they would do whatever job you gave them. So what did we do? Well, what do you do? We disclosed to Kaseya, and Kaseya has been very cooperative with us. I think it was 2 days later or a day later that we were in a call with the CTO, who was really scared that we were an American party that would give them 30 days to fix everything and then everything would be published. I don't think that makes the internet more safe. If you want to have that debate, let's do it outside with a beer. They had a strong focus on fixing it. They asked us several times to retest findings once they fixed it. In the meantime, we could build an NSE script, an nmap script to scan for exposed Kaseya instances. And we could scan there because there was an OpenAPI endpoint, and that OpenAPI endpoint kindly sent back the IP address it was running on, which version it was running, and a customer code. And that was a 4-digit customer code or 4-letter customer code that Kaseya knew which customer it was, and that turned out to be quite handy. We found about 2,200 Kaseya instances, remember each having about 100 times 100, 10,000 systems connected to it. Maybe. We never actually found out, but it was huge. And we didn't do a disclosure at that point in time, because at that point in time, if we would have done a disclosure, we were afraid that this would lead to a very significant ransomware campaign. So fast forwarding to the 2nd of July. I was sitting by the campfire with my group of scouts. I'm a member of scouts, so I feel very at home here among the hackers and the scouts. And you know you're in trouble when you walk away from the campfire and you've missed 30 calls and got about 90 messages. Vitz had a similar experience. He's got a ping from Kaseya. It's like, hey, can you come online in a meeting? And he opens up his desktop. For some reason, he had LinkedIn open. I don't think you're searching for a job anymore. And there was like this news article, ransomware attack on Kaseya FSA. Okay, Fuck. So we started a crisis call. And then we remembered, yeah, but we have a list of exposed VSA instances. Now, we do need to verify. It was about a month old then. We did send out notifications, hey, you're likely running Kaseya VSA. It's a good idea to do it to not connect it to the internet anymore. We provided a list of services to Kaseya. We helped them with the crisis management. We helped them with their decision to take the system, the SaaS service offline. We started a new scan with Zmap and that Nmap and that NSE script, and we rinsed and repeated. And then our then CISO was like, fuck, did they attack us? Did they get the exploits from us? Whoa, they did something differently, it turned out. They are using the same authentication bypass that we found, but they were using a different vulnerability, which was a file upload vulnerability. Arbitrary file upload, then called a file, which called for local file inclusion, file code execution, and then update the task list and install ransomware everywhere. And by the way, they do went for money. The other reason why we think they never hacked us is, well, a thorough investigation. Thank you for that. The other part was we had this more nasty exploit here on the top. We had a direct remote code execution would have made this attack so much more efficient from their perspective and so much more hurtful for us. It worked, as in, the number of Kaseya instances in our baseline scan 1 and 2 was about 2,200. Overnight, it dropped to about 600. Then it dropped during the day to about 50. And on the 4th of July, obviously on the 4th of July, I remember having calls with people who were on boats with barbecues in the background. It even dropped lower. Part of these things went offline because they got encrypted. And companies were in panic mode. Others went offline because we told them so. And I actually got the feedback like, yeah, this is the third time we're being called to take it offline. It was just a system to see what happens. We're taking it offline. And on the 4th of July, there were no Kaseya VSA systems online in the Netherlands at all. But it also didn't. Because Coop Supermarket in Denmark had to close down 500 stores. About 1,500 organizations got their entire businesses crypted, were crippled. Which reminds me of Miko's tweet from a while back. Rarely has anyone been thanked for the work they did to prevent a disaster that didn't happen. We were planning to do that. We failed and we got thanked profusely. Why wasn't the SaaS version affected? Because there's also a SaaS version of Kaseya VSA. Well, because it doesn't have the authentication bypass. They use a different method. Everything else worked but the authentication bypass. So if we would have been hacked, the disaster would have been a lot bigger. So one of the things we got challenged on is the long way to exposure. Why didn't we disclose earlier? Like I said, we had better exploits than Revil. It would have worked on the SaaS version too. They would have made a bigger disaster. But we did learn to be more firm on vendors. Because if you wait too long, you'll be the next. If you get a call from us that there's a problem with your product, it's kind of nice if you listen. It had a very satisfying ending, in the sense that the Revil ransomware gang was arrested in Russia, which is all the better. And it put us on the map. Which leads me to the second case, Leonard.
Thank you. No mic?
Hello?
Yeah, it works.
All right. Like you can see on the screen, sorry. I wanted to talk about two different cases that were quite unique for us, and that's why I think they're interesting to talk about. They're the global charities and our global healthcare case. Like Chris told you earlier, we're usually scanning for known CVEs or in the case of Kaseya, working with vendors to disclose our own zero-day research, but these two are different. The cases we ran were 39 in 2021, and we've already surpassed that number in 2022, so we're working really hard at that. And we were happily chugging along with that, and then this happened. A cyber attack on the Red Cross, where data of vulnerable people was in danger. So the cyber attack happened because of an unpatched server, and the server happened to be Managed Engine from Zoho. And at that point, we were like, "Huh? We know this name. Have we looked at this? Did we not look at this? Why wasn't this prevented by us?" So we looked back and we were like, "Hey, we did make a Slack channel for this. We looked into it." But sadly, it turned out that there was no benign way to scan for this vulnerability without very high chance of harming the systems. So we couldn't scan for it and warn the users, which made us quite sad because we really wanted to help. But in helping, of course, we have to follow our code of conduct. We're not for hire. We don't target individual organizations. So at this moment, we had to be a little hacky of our own code of conduct. And instead of targeting a single organization we wanted to help, like the Red Cross, we decided to scan all the charities and healthcare providers we could find. This resulted in two new cases, which you can see here, our global charity vulnerabilities and our global healthcare vulnerabilities cases. And this was for us an entirely new approach, because usually we send an email and then for a commercial party, "Hey, you know now, you are aware, please fix, it's your responsibility." But we really cared about these NGOs and charities and all the good work they are doing. So we really wanted to help them, give them a bit more aftercare, really chase down the fixes, do the follow-up. And for a change, we were not scanning for a single vulnerability, but we were scanning for all the things we could find that would put these organizations at risk. So we did it. We managed to help them find a lot of vulnerabilities, get a lot of them resolved, receive nice thank you messages. And then you think, we're done. No, we're not done now. Because what's next? We have these lists of IP spaces and domains that we can now link to these organizations whose work we find so important. So in any new case that we run, we can check our list of results for these organizations and give them the same aftercare that we did in these two unique cases. And that's how we'll be moving forward, trying to help these organizations that also do their best to make the world a better place. Because we think it's really needed, as we see, definitely see a pattern in these organizations that they're so busy doing the good work, or in cases of charities and NGOs, not always have the funds to do cybersecurity well. And that's a pattern we're seeing in various cases. And one of these different cases is the Zimbra case, which Frank will now tell you a bit more about.
Yeah, Zimbra. Zimbra was a different case. It was one of those cases where we looked for something that was already being exploited. And with Zimbra, it was a cross-site scripting that was used in Operation Email Thief. The dear people at Velexity, who do some excellent work every now and then, actually identified a campaign in which an attacker first sent a reconnaissance mail, then a couple of days later sent another mail if the account was actually active. And if somebody clicked on the mail while being logged into Zimbra webmail, that link would successfully redirect to a URL and all your email would go to their CNC server. All of it. So Zimbra is a product that's like Outlook or Exchange. It's a groupware product, email client, scheduling, those kind of things. And it had a lot of potential victims. Well, back on that first date, the 14th of December, there were roughly 65,000 Zimbra servers in the IPv4 space that were all vulnerable. And there were things like European government bodies, media, universities, Ukraine government and ISPs, Russian government bodies. Those kind of organizations are important. Data getting stolen from universities is not a good thing generally. On the 7th of February, the number of vulnerable servers was reduced to 31,000, because at that point in time, there was actually a patch. Some people could patch. But this was still exploited in the wild. That number went down on the 14th of February to about 24,000, and then it stabilized on the 14th of March. But we're not really sure if it stabilized, because it turned out that there were two ways to upgrade your Zimba server. One is chuck it away, get a new one, install the new software. The other one was a hotfix. And that hotfix did fix the vulnerability, but didn't change the version number in the front end. So we were doubtful if those numbers that we were seeing were actually vulnerable clients. So at that point in time, we decided, OK, we're not going to continue on this path. We did some research. We couldn't find any more reliable way to do fingerprinting. And that was the end of this talk. With that, I'm going to give it over to Astrid. And while Astrid is coming here, it's one of those cases where you end up not on high, but with a little bit of information. Yeah.
I was just listening to your talk, and I was really impressed. So I only have two hands, and now I have three things. So, well, hello, everybody. I'm going to tell you something really exciting about governance. Who doesn't want to know anything about governance? Let's see how this works. I'm going to tell you a little story. It started somewhere in winter 42. No, I'm just kidding. It started with a man with a dream. His nickname is OX Dude. I don't know if you know, ever heard of this guy. It's Victor Gevers. I hope you can see the stream now, because last time I gave a big shout out to you. Victor is, he's getting better at the moment, so he can't be here. But Victor, we love you, we miss you, we're very proud of you. And I'm going to tell the story about DIVD. They call it Dutch Institute for Vulnerability Disclosure. I call it, this is Victor's dream. This is Victor's dream, because it all started with this dude. So please, a big shout out, a big handout to Victor. We miss you. We love you. Thank you. I'm not going to cry this time, so I'm just going to tell the story. Because Victor started this whole dream in his own way. Like, he took a sabbatical, not in 2014, 2015, or 2017, no, in 2016, because it was a leap year, so there was one more day, 360 days, and he could find vulnerabilities. He did a lot. I don't know the number, but it's really big. And this is how it all started. And then he wanted to make his dream bigger, and he asked Chris and me to help him. And, well, then Frank came, Leonard came, and then hundred volunteers came. And this is how we became this bunch of nice people. We have a supervisory board, we have a board, we have a director, we have a management team, and 100 volunteers. We are looking all happy here, so, I think we are. So now you can see this beautiful picture about how we thought about how you make a good volunteer organization. What do you want to do? You want to make sure your volunteers are happy. So we have a board, we have a supervisory board who tells us to, take care of this and don't do that. And then we do it anyways, because we are a bunch of hackers. And we also have our director, Chris, who never done this before. So that is why we wanted him. We have a research, we have C-cert, we have operations, we have HRM, communication, finance, compliance. It almost sounds like a real company, but still, it's built with people who never done this before, and we are doing a fucking awesome job. Just saying. Then the next step we decided to start is the academy, because we have a lot of youngsters who want to become a hacker. But well, sometimes you have to teach them how to do it in an ethical way. And this is what we call the advanced kitten herding. We have a big dream with the DIVD Academy. We also have a board there. And I have to say, we are a real own foundation since 2 days. So I'm very happy to announce it finally worked. Barry van Kampen, also known as Fish, and Victor Geves, also known as ZeroX Dude, and me are the founders. We have a hell of a board. We have Max, he's sitting somewhere there. We have Sharesh, and we have Barry as the chair. And what we really want to do is to teach our youngsters, because we are all getting old, not me, but other people are getting old, and we want to learn them the stuff. They have the skills. They don't learn it at school. They want to make the world a better place. DIVD wants to make the world a better place. We need our youngsters to start learning stuff like this. So we thought, well, we're just going to hack the school system. We're going to build our own school. That's the DIVD Academy. I can tell for hours about that, but I'm not going to bore you anymore. If you want to know more, just ask me. This is a very important thing also, because we are, like Chris told, DIVD, we do it in a Dutch way, we're focusing on Dutch whatever, and then we found out we need our peers around the world, like in every country, we really need a DIVD who do the same stuff. So we started CCERT Global with Ewart Driehuis. I'm not sure his talk was already tomorrow or tonight at 11. Chris is going to tell you more about that. But this is really important, because we need to grow to make the internet a safer place for all of us, for our youngsters, for myself. I want to be one day when I'm really old, I'm still very young, I want to be on the internet and enjoy information, wants to be free. I want to be free. I want to talk to everybody I know in a safe way. And I think we at DIVD, we can handle that. Is this the moment I give you the microphone? Oh, look at our tent. Okay, I'm going to, yes.
That will do.
So this was the boring part, yeah.
No, don't need it. Didn't need the clicker. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Astrid. So you can see us here across the abacus. This is our tent. You probably saw the lawnmower. Yes, Wietse also hacked that one. Well, not only this device, but the online platform. So he's now sending all these lawnmowers here to MCH. If you see him approaching at the gate, again, it is Wietse. You can come there if you want to join DIVD as a researcher or a CCERTer. And if you want to build up your own chapter in your country, Ewart Driehuis will be giving a talk tonight at 11 o'clock. We already are setting up a chapter in the US and the UK. And these chapters, they actually translate our findings to the local context. So you can imagine that if you have a list of IP addresses on the US, say, we can send them emails, but they don't know what DIVD is, and they might think, well, it's fraud or, you know, a bunch of criminals. If there's organizations in the US, they can also translate it to their constituencies on what this actually means. They can also interpret it. Researchers from the US can also work with us through CCERT Global, so we can kick off a scan with their methods, etc. I'm really looking forward to a German chapter, so this is my cry out to all the wonderful Germans helping out on MCH. I know vulnerability disclosure is very difficult in Germany, especially compared to the Netherlands, but we need you. And this is also my call out to the Belgium colleagues, because vulnerability disclosure in Belgium is much easier, but we might need some translation, French, something like that. And we're also working on Sweden and Japan, so hopefully more countries will join.
10:40, not 11.
Ah, 10:40, very well, because then he's just finished before Symphony of Fire is starting. I know everybody wants to go there, so join Edward, his talk. So you can join us in the tent to talk vulnerability disclosure, become a member. You can do all sorts of jobs on communication, on legal, selling coffee, or you know, new logo design, stuff like that. And it's fun to do. So if you want us online, you can do it. So if you join us, we can answer questions here, but also questions from the internet for the people at home. Are there questions from the internet? Maybe later. Oh.
Right, we want one. Oh, we have a question here, so go ahead.
My question is, do you have plans for IPv6, and if so, what are they?
Sorry?
Do you have plans for IPv6, and if so, can you tell us what they are?
Plans for IPv6? Yes. Well, yeah, we can't just run a scan on IPv6 because it's too large, but do we have any workarounds to enfold that?
Well, one of the reasons we're here is because there's a great bunch of brilliant minds here. One of the obvious solutions would be to ask everybody what your IPv6 range you actually use and give it to us to scan. Unfortunately, that means we are a scanning for hire company then, and so ethically we can't go there. Otherwise, I think the plans are a bit hard.
We are aware of the problem. That's a good start. Real actionable plans right now, no. It's just too large to scan the entire space, but there would be options like looking at which blocks are announced, etc., to reduce the space that you need. We're also in touch with an amazing PhD researcher in Glasgow who does her master thesis about this. So we're aware of the problem and we're looking how we're going to scale up and how we deal with it. But for now, most servers still have an IPv4 address, so we can just get by like we do right now.
Yeah, plus, if it's not that we don't care about IPv6. If we come across in Shodan something in the IPv6 range and we can inform people, we will. But it's just too big to scan, or Shodan, or other senses, or other data. So if a DNS points to IPv6, we'll also include it. But it's just, too big to scan for now.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so if you want our scans, you want to be safe, don't use IPv6. No, just a joke.
Do use IPv6. It's time that we start using this thing that's been around for years.
Yes.
Do we have another question at the back?
Yes. First of all, thanks for all your good work. I think DIVD helps a lot of people. But my question is, I see on the internet, because of the privacy regulations, that email addresses and these contact details get most of the time redacted. How are you even able to find the email addresses to the companies where that IP address or the domain name belongs after that is redacted? Or does it make your work harder?
Yeah, so the internet, unlike CAMP, has very poor signage. You can wander around and never know whose village you're in or which camp you're stumbling in, and there's not always helpful hints there. Those companies that keep their Whois database up to date with their abuse address, thank you very much, that really helps. Security TXT is going to help, especially the DNS version is going to help us a lot, because we don't just want to see your website, we want to use DNS to do a reverse lookup and get security information there. Sometimes it's guessing. There's countries where, if you look in the AFNIC database, there's a lot of IP addresses that just have a telephone number for abuse. I don't have the time to call all African ISPs. Please keep your Whois records up to date. Please put a security text in. That really, really helps us.
Thank you for the presentation. You were in the news a couple of days back regarding the solar panel stuff, right?
Yes, correct.
Yesterday.
Great. And that It's of course very scary stuff, and many thanks for all the hard work in that. My question is, are you any plans for other converters to check?
Which ones do you have?
I have three Goodweeds.
So obviously this topic has our attention. On the other hand, we're limited by the amount of time we have. We are doing competitor research. We're not after certain vendors. Solomon just happened to be the unlucky one that we found first. I guess the state of IoT security would be another talk on itself.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and Frank already did. So if people are viewing at home and think, what is this about? Look at the internet outage technology, you called it, right?
Yeah, international outage technology.
International outage technology, and it was, we discovered a management panel for many converters, and it needed to be closed off because, you can do nasty stuff with that. So if you want to watch back that talk, it's available now. Yes.
You already gave an plan on expanding, on going abroad and distributing DFAD to other countries. If we speak again in 5 years, what things would you have what would you like to see that happened, or where you stand then?
I think that's a question we all might answer. Shall I kick off? Yep. In 5 years, we have grown from 100 to several hundred researchers to do all the work we need to do. So each high is being scanned in a sufficient manner and also reported to the whole world. So we need more researchers, more C-cert people to do that. Also, that it is still a voluntary organization, but that these people are committed to stay with us. Three is that each country in the world has its own chapter, and forwarding our findings too. We're already building in the Netherlands our own network of trusted information sharing partners who put our notifications to their constituencies. So like through internet service providers, we had ZCert for healthcare, we have DTC for small medium enterprise, we have the National Cybersecurity Center for the government. That model might be exported to other countries, helping about, so it's not only our effort, but other countries are helping too. And I hope that in 5 years we still exist and that we didn't have a court case which bankrupted us. So those are my four visions for the coming 5 years. Astrid, what is your vision for the coming 5 years for DFVD and also, of course, the Academy?
My vision is we will grow, and the same points you gave, but also that everybody will recognize us and know we are the good guys and girls and people. We are the good people, I must say. For the Academy, I really want to be a real school where kids can be happy. If you put a fish and a monkey in front of a tree and you say to the fish, climb the tree, then you know it will never happen. But the fish has also very good skills. So that's what we want to do with our kids, our youngsters, to tell them they're good enough for this world. They are fucking smart. We're going to teach them to use their skills in an ethical way, and we're going to make sure they become our new generation of pen testers. That is my dream. That is Victor's dream, I know. We also want to make sure that people who are sitting at home at the moment don't get a job because they have different skills. We want to make sure they get the jobs they love, they need, and we need them. So that's my vision for the future. It's more about people. And we're gonna make sure that we hack our way into the next generation, because somebody has to do it, so we will do this. Anyone else?
Leonard, in 5 years, then probably people are fed up with me and you'll be the director of DIVD. So where does DIVD stand in 5 years?
I was going to start with, in 5 years, I hope to do less managing and more hands-on hacking again, but thanks for that. No, I think in 5 years that I really hope we are reaching, having global reach and having a better way of reaching potential victims. Because right now, the abuse addresses, we rely a lot on ISPs forwarding our message. And some of them do, and some of them just refuse to work with us. which is a shame because it means we don't reach certain people. So I really hope we can find a solution to that part of the problem.
Yeah. So being the crisis manager, I'm going to hope for the best and plan for the worst.
Did you have a boring job?
I'm going to hope for the best, and I hope that in 5 years we're going to stand here and say that the IVD is going to be reduced to just the academy, because we were able to do zero cases in the last 5 years, or in the last year. Failing that, I think we have a lot of ways to do to make that signage on the internet better. Right now, scanning is a batch process. So we scan, there's a lot of verification, messages relayed, and then they go to your ISP or your colo provider or your network provider, who might give it to your colo provider, who might give it to their customer, who's the customer of another customer. And then the message may never get there. And I hope that we can, in the Netherlands, build an infrastructure to automatically get these things there in minutes from us detecting there's something wrong, and hoping to expand that infrastructure globally so that people really get notified, hey, you have a problem, really, really soon. So that we can do more cases, reach more people, and maybe focus on finally fixing IPv6.
Okay, cool. And actually, I've got a last question. At the moment, this is very much seems a labor of love, and that you've put in and grown up and passionate about what you do. Do you feel confident about your funding and sustainability going forward?
Well, I would rather turn it around. At the FED, many researchers are already doing this job. And joining us, you know, it's a huge relief to see other people doing the same. And you help each other out. So the FED is not only an environment where we try to make the internet safer, but also improve ourselves by learning from each other. But yes, sustainability is difficult. We do have some funding, both from governments, charity funds, to get a little payment for a management layer, but also for all our expensive IT stuff we need. But then again, each time we try to buy a new server or a license, they say, oh, you're a DVD, here's for free, go. But bottom line is that if we don't have any money, we'll still be doing it. So yeah, I'm pretty confident for sustainability. That is, we might get into a difficult case, for example, like with Solarman. It might turn into a court case. I hope not, because, well, I hope people see that it's necessary what we do. Any other comments on sustainability?
Well, I think sustainability for me, I think if you do something you truly believe in are, you can go on for a while. I work for the IVD, but it doesn't feel like work. It feels like I get to be who I am. And that, for me, is the most important part of what I do.
Yeah, I agree with Frank here. And like Chris said as well, a lot of us have been doing responsible disclosure anyway, and we would still be doing it without the IVD. So if day-to-day lacks the funding, we'll just continue doing what we do and keep doing day-to-day, because we started without a lot of funding as well.
Yeah. It will make your job a lot worse.
It does. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Chris, Astrid, Frank, Leonard. Get my pronunciations right. Thank you very, very much indeed.